Alicia MacCready fainted, the reaction of an hysteric. Mr. Person and some of her friends gathered around. The other people began to file out of the great room, the business of the evening behind them. I got up and switched off the vid. "How would you have voted?" I asked.
"I don't know that much about things like this," Zena said, looking up.
She'd only been half paying attention.
"They don't give her anything? A horse or weapons or a helipack or anything when they put her off on a colony planet?"
"I don't think so."
"Well, isn't that pretty harsh?"
"It's like Mr. Tubman said. We've got rules that have to be followed. If people don't follow the rules, they can't stay here." They were doing her a favor by even letting the assembly vote on the question. Zena looked sour and said, "What will your father do if he comes home and finds that you haven't thrown out the dinner things?" "Oh, heavens," I said. "I'd forgotten about that." "I'm likely to put off little bits of drudgery, even when they wouldn't take long to settle." I had managed to put the dinner remains completely out of mind. As I was collecting the dishes and throwing them in the incinerator, Zena, standing by, said,
"Why are you so strong on rules?"
"What do you mean?"
"Well, you're so set on the rules that you won't allow any mistakes at all. And that MacCready woman is going to die now."
I stopped stacking dishes. I looked at her. "I didn't even vote. I had nothing to do with what was decided."
"That isn't the point," she said.
But she didn't say what the point was. Daddy came home about 10 minutes later. I asked him if things had gone as he had expected them to, and he said yes.
"I cleared up the dishes," I said.
Daddy said, "I never doubted you would for a minute." At our next meeting, I asked Mr. Mbili if he'd expected the decision to go the way it had.
"I wasn't surprised," he said. "Your father's point of view is widely shared in the ship. That is why he's chairman."
Chapter 9. It may sound like an anachronism to speak of seasons on a ship, but we always did. That is, July, August, and September were summer, as an example. This never struck me as odd until I was 15 or 16, when I was going into the factors responsible for planetary weather, and one day I really thought about the meaning of the terms we used so casually. It was obvious that, through time, they had lost their weatherly connotations, and now simply referred to quarters of the year. Well, for that matter, the fact that we use the old Earth year at all is an anachronism, but we do it anyway. At the time I was doing my puzzling about this, I mentioned it to a friend of mine. Since he appears in this book several times, I won't mention his name. He has enough burdens without being made to sound stupid here. I said, "Do you realize that our calling November fall means that most of the people on the ship probably came originally from the northern temperate zone on Earth?" He said,
"Well, if you wanted to know that, all you have to do is call for the original ship lists from the library."
I said, "But don't you think this is interesting?" He said,
"No."
Perhaps stupid is not the word I intended. Perhaps contentious. In any case, the summer when I was 12 passed. I think of it as a busy block with a whole number of items, and I'm not sure in what exact order any of them happened. I could invent an order, but since none of them is central, I won't. For instance, during that summer, I had my first menstrual period. That's important insofar as I took it as a sign that I was growing up, but that's about all you can say for it. Then there were dancing lessons. You might well wonder what we were doing with dancing lessons, but they were actually part of our survival class training. Mr. Marichal said,
"This isn't meant to be fun, and it isn't meant to be funny. It is deadly serious. You stumble over your own feet. You don't know what to do with your hands. When you are in a position where you have to do the exact right thing in an instant, deft movement is the most important element. You want your body to work for you, not against you. Not only, by God, am I going to give you dancing lessons, but I'm going to start you on needlepoint.
We not only got needlepoint, dancing lessons, hand-to-hand combat training, and weapon instruction, but Mr. Marischal was our tutor in all of them. He showed us films of people drawing handguns and dropping them, of people falling off horses, I did that a couple of times myself, of people in a blue funk. The films were taken on an obstacle course where, for instance, if you didn't watch out, the ground might suddenly fall out from underneath your feet. There might be a rope to grab, or you might simply have to land without breaking your ankle. At the end of the summer, when we moved up from 6th class to 5th, we started going through obstacle courses ourselves. The primary aim was not to teach us any individual skill, but how to react smoothly and intelligently in difficult situations. We were shown how to do individual things, but that wasn't the primary aim of the instruction. All of this adds up to the fact that I had been wrong in thinking it would be simply businesslike first to last. Survival class was earnest, it was businesslike, but it was intelligent and interesting too. What it was not was an adventure. But since I had my desire for an adventure settled very shortly, it no longer bothered me that survival class was not an adventure. Survival class gave me a whole new set of friends, and they began taking up enough of my time that I saw less of people like Xena Andrus. I did see Mary Carpentier once more, but we found that we didn't have a great deal to say to one another, and we never seemed to call each other again. Most important, though, out of the 31 of us in the survival class, there drew together a nuclear group of 6. This was hardly pure friendship, since some of my best friends were not in it, and Benny Morlock was. It was just the group. We drew together originally through a non-adventure. At Jimmy's urging, I took a group of kids up to the 6th level, and we spent the day exploring. The 6 of us who went were me and Venny and Jimmy, Helen Pack, Riggy Allen, and Attila Zabidi. Attila and Helen, and, I guess, Jimmy, were my particular friends. Riggy was a good friend of Attila's, and Helen and Riggy both saw something in Venny. That was the way the group hung together, and the trip to the 6th level? I guess it was something of an adventure for some of the others, and it was fun for me. Provided another bond. We usually saw each other for an hour or two after each survival class, and sometimes on weekends. There were a few others who joined us from time to time, but they were just comers and goers. After survival class one day, 5 of us were in the snackery of the common room of Levquad, on the 5th level. By shuttle, this wasn't really far from entry gate 5, and it was the most convenient central point for all of us. A few changes on the shuttle, and we were all home. We didn't know anybody in Levquad, and we couldn't have found our way around it very well. But still, we had our place here, our regular corner, and after a little while, we no longer felt so much like intruders. The missing number was Jimmy. He'd been hurrying off one place and another during the past week after class, mumbling and chuckling around as though he had his little business and would be damned if he'd tell it, and in the meantime was enjoying it thoroughly. I was doodling on a piece of paper, working out an idea I had in mind. We were sitting at the table with food and drink, but not a lot of it. We were mostly taking up table space and talking. Our regular table was this one, a red-topped affair set in a corner on the left in the under-14 area. We were talking of a prospective soccer game to be played on Saturday morning in Attila's home quad, Rothquad on the 4th level, if we could raise the necessary players. I was thinking that I'd certainly come a long way from the time, not that long ago, when all it took to page me was a simple call on my home quad speaker system. I was no longer quite the stick at home I'd been then.
"Will Jimmy play?"
Attila asked. He was the biggest among us, but a quiet boy for all that. He generally didn't say a lot, but would just sit back and then from time to time come out with some comment that was completely surprising. And all the more surprising because he wasn't the person you'd pick as likely to say anything bright or clever or knowledgeable.
"Mia can ask him," Helen said.
"All right," I said. "I'll have him call you."
Unless he's too busy with this whatever it is of his. I think he'll want to play. He's a good halfback. I turned my attention back to my scribble.
What is that you're doing there? Riggy asked, and snatched it away.
Riggy is somebody I have to describe as a meatball. He was hardly my favorite person in the world. He's one of those people who have no governor, who'll do the first thing that pops into their heads whether or not it makes a lick of sense, and then, if necessary, be heartily sorry afterward. He wasn't stupid or clumsy or incompetent. He simply had no sense of proportion at all.
"And what's that supposed to be?" he asked, pointing at the paper.
Venny and Helen, on his side of the table, both looked at it, too. After several tries, I had drawn what was reasonably recognizable as a fist seen palm on, holding a long, clean arrow.
I'm no artist, and I'd had to keep sneaking looks at my own hand to get even a moderately accurate picture. The arrow I'd managed to draw without benefit of a model.
I made a grab for it, but Riggy held it out of reach.
Uh-uh,
he said, passing it on to Venny farther down the table. She looked at it with a frown, making sure at the same time that I wasn't able to grab it back. I shrugged and said, "It's a picture with a meaning, if you must know. It's sort of a pictorial pun."
"A rebus?"
Attila suggested. "I guess it is."
"Let me see it,"
he said, and took it from Venny.
"I don't get it," Venny said. "An arrow held in a hand."
"A fist," Riggy said.
"The hand's closed."
Tiredly, I said, "It's my name. Have arrow? Have arrow."
"Oh, no," Venny said. "That's pretty poor."
Helen said, "I don't think it's too bad. I think it's a pretty clever idea." "An ill-favored thing but mine own," I quoted tartly. Venny gave me a disgusted look.
"You are a show-off, aren't you? What was that supposed to be?"
"Mia's reading Shakespeare for her tutor," Helen said. "That's all. She's been memorizing lines." Riggy took the doodle back and gave it another look. "You know, this is a good idea.
I wonder if I could work my name out somehow."
We spent some time trying, working on all our names. It didn't come out terribly well. By stretching, we got Pack, a little knapsack for Helen. But that wasn't truly homonymous. Zabadi and Alan were pretty well unworkable.
"I've got one," Riggy said, after some moments of concentration, during which he wouldn't show anybody what he was doing.
Triumphantly, he held up a sheet with a series of locks drawn on it.
"More lock,"
he said.
"Get it?"
We got it, but we didn't like it. He had covered the whole sheet with his drawings, which is hardly what you'd call concise. I'd been working on the same name myself. I came up with a fair to middling troglodyte.
"What's that?" Attila asked.
"It's Morlock again." Venny didn't look pleased, and Riggy immediately challenged,
"How do you get Morlock out of that thing?"
"It's from an old novel called The Time Machine. There's a group of underground monsters in it called Morlocks."
"You're making that up," Venny said.
"I'm not either," I said. "You can look the book up for yourself. I read it when I was in Alfing, so all you have to do is call for the facsimile." Venny looked at the drawing again. Then she said,
"All right, I'll look it up. I may even use it."
I almost liked her for saying that, since I hadn't been very kind in bringing up the subject. If my name had been Morlock, I might have used the troglodyte idea myself. But I hadn't really expected Venny to stomach the idea. It took more, not quite objectivity, but detachment from herself, than I thought she had. Just then Attila said,
"Here comes Jim."
Jimmy Dentremont came between the tables, snaked up a free chair from the next table over, and plunked it down beside me.
"Hi," he said.
"Where have you been?"
Helen asked for all of us. Helen is a very striking girl. She has blonde hair and oriental eyes. Eyes with an epicanthic fold. And it's a wild combination. Jimmy just shrugged and pointed at our various little doodles.
What's all this?
We explained it to him.
Oh, he said. That's easy. I can get one for me with no trouble.
He picked up a pencil and sketched two mountains, and then put a little stick figure man between them. I looked blankly at him, and so did the others.
My name means between mountains, he explained.
It does? Riggy asked. In French.
I didn't know you knew French, I said.
I don't.
I just looked my name up because I knew it was originally French.
How about that? Attila said. I wonder if my name means something in Hungarian.
Jimmy cleared his throat, looked around at us, and then said to me, Mia, do you remember our bet about my finding an adventure?
Yes.
Well, I've found one. That's what I've been working on the past few days.
Helen immediately asked for an explanation of what we were talking about, and I had to wait to ask Jimmy just what it was that I was in for until he had finished explaining.
If this was a bet, what were the stakes involved? Riggy asked.
Jimmy looked at me questioningly. Then he said,
I don't think we settled that.
I assumed it was that if I found an adventure, Mia would have to go along. Everybody looked at me, and I said,
All right. I guess so.
Okay, Jimmy said. This is it. We're going to go outside the ship. On the outside of the ship.
Isn't that dangerous? Helen asked.
It's an adventure, Jimmy said.
Adventures are supposed to have an element of danger, be fraught with peril and all that.
Is it dangerous outside the ship? I asked.
I don't know. Jimmy admitted. I don't know what it's like out there. I couldn't find out. I did try. Finding out should be part of the fun. Besides, even if that's easy, there are some hard parts. We've got to have suits to go outside, and we've got to get ourselves outside. Neither of those will be easy.
I want to go too, Riggy said.
Jimmy shook his head.
This is just Mia and me. We are going to need help, though, and if you want to help us, you're welcome.
The kids looked at each other around the table, and then they all nodded. We were a group, after all, and this was just too good to miss. The six of us walked in a body through a corridor on the first level. Jimmy walked a step or two ahead of us, leading the way. There is something to being a part of a group, busy on purposes of its own. Something exciting. Even if it is melodramatic, even if it is 90% hokum, it is fun. I was enjoying myself, and so were the others. I could hardly restrain myself from practicing surreptitious glances behind us, simply because they seemed in keeping with the part we were playing. Jimmy turned half around and pointed ahead and to the left.
It's around here.
There was a little foyer there a couple of feet deep, and then a blank black door. Completely featureless. In our world, that is unusual. People ordinarily lavish considerable care in making their surroundings lively and personal. Consequently, the ship is quite a colorful place to live in. A black door like this, with neither design nor decoration, was obviously meant to say stay out to anybody who came by.
The airlock to the outside is in the room behind the door there, Jimmy said.
The door had no obvious button, knob, slide, latch, or handle. Only a single hole for an electronic key. This sort of key, when inserted, would emit an irregular signal of an established frequency, and the door would open. Attila and Jimmy were the two of us that knew something about electronics, and they looked the door over carefully together. After a moment, Attila said,
It's just a token lock.
What's that? I asked. We were standing in a half circle around the two boys and the door. He said,
This lock is just to keep the door closed, and to let people know the door is supposed to be closed, and that's about all. I'll have to work on it a couple of times, and I can get through.
Jimmy said,
Can you be through by next Saturday? A week from tomorrow?
Oh, sure.
Let's plan to go then. Helen, you work with Attila. You be his lookout and make sure he doesn't get caught fooling around here and ruin everything.
Then he turned to the other three of us.
All right. Let's go see about getting the suits.
Helen said,
But can't I go?
I don't want to miss out.
It was interesting. Of the six of us, Jimmy was the next to smallest, and yet he dominated the group when he wanted to.
There is something to the idea of natural leadership ability.
Jimmy said, We have to have somebody be lookout. Besides, you'll be here when we go outside. The only thing you're going to miss is swiping the suits.
To get to salvage, our next stop, we cut through engineers. That saved us a long trip around. The four of us must have made considerable noise, because as we were passing down the main hall of offices, an elderly woman popped out of one of them behind us.
Hold on there, she said.
We turned around.
She was elderly.
Short, squarely built, white-haired, and obviously well over 100. Perhaps even as old as Mr. Mbili. She also looked thoroughly sour.
Well? What is it you're doing here making all this noise? Perhaps you don't realize it, but there is important work being done here.
Uneasily, Jimmy said that we were just passing through on our way to salvage, and that we meant no harm.
This is not a public highway, she said. If you have no business in engineers, you shouldn't be here. You children have no sense of fitness. Why are you going to salvage?
Jimmy and I were standing just behind Venny and Riggy, and her question was addressed to Jimmy.
It's a school assignment, Jimmy said.
That's right, I chimed in.
Her glance shifted to the other two of us.
What about you?
Instead of saying the obvious thing, Riggy said,
We're with them.
All right, the old lady snapped.
You first two go on, but don't come through here again. The other two of you, go on home.
Venny and Riggy looked helplessly at us, but then they turned and went reluctantly the other way. The old lady really had no right to chase them out, but she was so fierce and unarguable with that we just couldn't say a thing. Jimmy and I scooted on our way before she could add anything more. And she watched until both sets of us had definitely done as she said. Some people get a feeling of power from being unpleasant. Most of all, salvage smelled interesting. Salvage and repair are really little enclaves almost surrounded by the much larger engineers. There are offices and large machines and large projects a-building in engineers. Salvage and repair are just the tail end of the dog, without the personnel, resources, or neatness of engineers. Salvage was a crowded room, full of aisles and racks and benches and tables all in a pleasing state of disarray. It looked like the sort of place that you could poke around in for weeks or even months and always turn up something new and interesting. And hanging over it all was the most intriguing and unidentifiable odor I'd come upon. The smell alone was enough to make you want to spend your spare time here. We peeked in cautiously. There were a couple of technicians working and moving around.
Come on, Jimmy said. I know they have suits here somewhere, probably locked away.
We'll have to poke around.
We looked around as inconspicuously as possible, Jimmy taking one aisle and me taking the next. I was lost in a pile of broken toys when Jimmy grabbed at my elbow. I jumped.
Sorry, he said. I've found them. They're two rows over, and they're not locked away or anything. They're just in a rack.
How do you know they're safe to use? I said. I nudged a broken doll with my toe.
If they're like that, we might as well forget it.
These aren't in for repair, Jimmy said. These are the ones they'd use themselves if they had to go outside. They've got seals on from after the last time they were used.
The important thing is how we're going to sneak them out.
Uh-oh, watch out.
I turned to look. Just down the aisle, a pleasant-looking technician was coming toward us. He was a short, youngish man with mouse-colored hair.
"Well, what can I do for you kids?" he asked.
"I'm Mia Havero," I said. "This is Jimmy Dentremont."
"Hello," he said. "My name is Mitchell,"
and waited with eyebrows raised. I reached into my pocket and took out a couple of folded sheets of paper. Uncertainly, I said,
"I don't know if you can help us. Maybe this isn't the right place."
Jimmy stayed silent, watching my lead. Mr. Mitchell said,
"Well, we'll see. What is it that you've got?"
I showed him the sketches, Jimmy's and mine, that I'd taken from the table in Levquad, and explained how our names were involved.
"These are just rough," I said. "What we wanted to do was draw them a little better, and then work up pins to wear with these as designs."
"Hmm," Mr. Mitchell said.
"Yes,
I don't see why not. It may not fall strictly in our province, but it seems a worthwhile idea. I think I can help you. How does ceramic jewelry sound?"
"Great," Jimmy said. "Could we come down on a Saturday morning?"
Mr. Mitchell said,
"There's usually only one technician on duty on Saturdays, but I suppose..."
I said, "Could we make it a week from tomorrow? We have this big soccer game in the quad tomorrow, and we really ought to be there."
"Oh, sure," Mr. Mitchell said. "I'll even arrange to have the duty a week from tomorrow and help you myself."
After we had thanked him and walked away, Jimmy said,
"You certainly can lie. How'd you think that one up?"
"Which?"
"About the soccer game." "I didn't make that up," I said. "I was supposed to tell you. The kids want to play soccer tomorrow."
"Oh,"
Jimmy said. "Maybe you aren't such a good liar then."
Chapter 10. The score in the soccer game in Rothquad was 5-3. Attila and Venny and I were on the losing side. During the next week, we set our plans. With some practice, Attila had that door so well trained that it would practically pop open when he told it to, at least according to Helen. At looked pleased and didn't deny it. We had borrowing the suits set up pretty well, too. Jimmy sketched the location of the suits for Venny and Riggy.
"There'll be just one technician working on Saturday," Jimmy said. "And he'll be busy helping Mia and me. All you two have to do is sneak easy. As soon as we can, we'll join you in the airlock room."
I had some spare time, and Jimmy didn't. So I took Venny and Riggy down to salvage for a quick scout around. Mr. Mitchell was in the back, but I made sure we didn't attract his attention. We were in. I pointed to the suits, and we were out again in no more than 20 seconds. On our way back, though, the same old woman stopped us in engineers and lectured us again. She had her desk placed so that she could see everybody who passed in the hall, and I guess come out to exterminate anyone who she thought had no business being there. Her name, displayed on her desk, was Keithley. She more than awed me. She scared me. As soon as she turned away, we three scooted.
"You'd better not come this way when you have the suits," I said. "Think what would happen if she caught you."
Riggy paled and shook his head.
"She shouldn't have stopped us," Venny said. "We weren't making any noise this time."
She agreed to make a detour when they had the suits, however. Things aren't always fair, I guess. Actually, the old lady wasn't the only thing I was afraid of. I didn't really like the idea of going outside the ship, and the more I thought about it, the less I liked it. The ship goes faster than the speed of light, the old Einstein barrier, by becoming discontinuous, the Kaufman-Chambers discontinuity equations. I know the thought of standing on the outside of the ship and looking at the inside of nothing excited Jimmy, but it did not excite me. It seems to be my nature to have second thoughts, and they came to me all through the week. Since it was far too late to back out without looking foolish, I didn't tell any of the others. But I began to regret ever having mentioned the word adventure. Perhaps the answer is that if you're going to do something impulsive, you should do it the way Riggy does.
Act while the impulse is clear and fresh, and don't allow any time for second thought.
Who won that soccer game of yours?
Mr. Mitchell said as he led the way through the maze of unrepaired, half-repaired, and repaired whatnot in salvage.
Jimmy's side did, I said.
Mine lost.
We really appreciate your helping us like this.
Oh, it's nothing at all, he said. Here we are. This is the kiln where we bake the finished pieces. Copper. That's for the base. Then an enamel and a surface painting on that. We can try it a couple of times until it comes out right.
He pointed at each item and, in fact, seemed more than pleased to help us. I think part of it was the chance to help out eager kiddies. Partly, he liked me because I was a cute little girl. And part was the sheer joy of operating the bake oven and making the jewelry. The pins were just an excuse for me, though I did find the idea of making them intriguing and the process interesting. I am not a tinkerer, however. Jimmy and Mr. Mitchell both were. They belonged to the let's putter around and see what happens school, and they got on very well together. We started by picking the copper backing, refining our sketches, and planning the colors we wanted to use. Gradually, I became relegated to the position of observer, while Jimmy took over the planning and execution of the jewelry with Mr. Mitchell, serving as over-his-shoulder advisor. That was after the first try, particularly mine, turned out badly. The first time I ever saw Jimmy Dentremont, he was tinkering. Or if he wasn't, at least that's the way I remember it. He was good at it, too. And that, combined with enthusiasm, mild mental myopia, and desire to dominate, sometimes carried him away. It wasn't the first time I'd gotten elbowed to the side by him. I didn't care for it particularly either. It was one of the things that made me wonder, our necessary association aside, if I really liked Jimmy. It wasn't really an important enough thing to get more than slightly irritated about today, since we had larger goals in mind. But I did resent mildly being put in a position where I had to work just to see enough over Jimmy's other shoulder to know what was going on. But, at least, having been put in the role of an observer, I did make an effort to observe, and I saw more than either Jimmy or Mr. Mitchell. When our second tries were in the oven, I poked Jimmy and said, Mr. Mitchell, it's about lunchtime.
Hmm?
Jimmy said, turning his attention from the oven to me. It was actually something on the early side for lunch, as Jimmy was perceptive enough to be aware. In his concentration on the job of the moment, our larger purposes had escaped him. I gave him another prod to restore his memory. I said, We can go and eat, and then come back to see how the pins turned out. Jimmy had the good sense to nod. Mr. Mitchell seemed a little bewildered. Mostly, I think, because he and Jimmy had been in rapport, working together to do the job, and now, all of a sudden, Jimmy was just dropping things and dashing off. But he said,
Oh, all right. Sure.
When we were in the hall beyond, Jimmy said, What I said last week about lies?
I was wrong. Boy, did that sound weak. Have to go to lunch.
Well, I didn't notice you thinking up anything better, I said quite tartly. I was walking determinedly enough that before Jimmy saw how fast I was going, I was a good bit ahead, and he had to push to catch up. It's my, I mean business and I'm more than just an ounce irked, pace.
What's the matter with you?
Jimmy asked.
I didn't mean anything.
It's not that, I said.
Well, what is it?
Nothing, I said. Then, they got the suits about half an hour ago. Venny waved at me.
You two had your heads down over the table.
I hope they got the smallest there were, Jimmy said. Suddenly, I put my hand on his elbow and stopped. Hold on there. We'd better go back and go around. I gestured at the hall ahead. I don't want to get bawled out by that old witch again.
Jimmy looked at me with an impish expression. It's the sort of expression his face, topped by red hair and set between prominent ears, is really fitted for.
Let's take a chance, he said. Let's just run for it, and if she comes out,
We won't stop at all.
Maybe it was my moment to be impulsive. The hall stretched before us like a gauntlet. The door to old Mrs. Keithley's office was open, and we were far enough out of her line of sight to allow us a running start. We had to go about 30 yards beyond it, turn a corner left, and then we'd be out of sight and out of practical reach.
All right, I said.
Feeling like little blonde-haired Susie Dangerfield running between the lines of hostile Iroquois braves, I took off. Jimmy was right with me on my left, and we pounded along. As we passed the old lady's office, I shot a glance right, but didn't see her. Jimmy out-accelerated me, and as we made for the corner, he was a step or two ahead.
Hey, slow down, I said. She isn't even there.
He turned his head to look back as he reached the corner, and still moving at considerable speed, crashed blindly into someone. Jimmy bounced off and into the wall, but didn't fall down. I skidded to a stop at the corner and looked down. It was Mrs. Keithley, white hair and all, sitting flat on her bottom with an expression of affronted dignity on her face. She looked up at me.
Hello, I said. Nice day, isn't it?
I stepped over her and walked at a very sedate pace down the hall. Jimmy was stunned momentarily, but then he made the best of things.
It was nice to see you again,
he said politely to the dear old lady, and then walked after me. I shot a glance back at her, and then Jimmy caught up with me, and we both broke into a run and left her looking speechlessly after us. When we were out of breath and out of sight, we stopped running and flung ourselves down, panting, on a flight of stairs. Then we started laughing, partly because it seemed terribly funny, and partly from sheer relief. When I'd caught my breath and stopped laughing, I looked soberly at Jimmy and said, I don't know about you, but I'm going to take the long way around from now on.
That's a pretty obvious thing to say, Jimmy said.
Well, I'm not a very brave person.
Oh, I'm not blaming you. I'm going to be careful, too.
When we got to the lock room, Helen was waiting in the hallway. All of us looked in both directions, and then Helen stepped up to the black door and gave a knock that was recognizably a signal and not a casual rapping by some passerby with an unaccountable desire to tap on black doors. The door swung open immediately, and we all piled inside. At, standing behind the door, gave us just enough time to get completely in and then shut the door behind us. The room was green-colored, small, and bare. The lock door was directly opposite the door we'd come in. The suits had been hung on racks that apparently were designed to hold them. Jimmy looked around in satisfaction.
Ah, he said. Very, very good.
Let's get the suits on, Mia. I looked around at Venny and Helen and At and said, Where's Riggy? At said,
I couldn't talk him out of it. He brought along an extra suit. You know how he wanted to go outside, too? Well, he went.
Looking very unhappy, Jimmy said,
Well, couldn't you stop him, Venny? You could have kept him from taking an extra suit.
Venny said defensively,
If you only wanted one suit between the two of you, I could have made him leave one behind.
He said he had as much right to go out as you two did. At said,
You know how mad he can get. We told him it wasn't a good idea, but he wouldn't have it any other way.
Oh, well, I said. Helen said, He's going to surprise you.
I guess so, Jimmy said, somewhat sourly. Well, let's go ahead with what's left of this adventure.
He was obviously quite disgruntled, but trying not to let it show. Or, perhaps, trying to let it show just enough so that he could be a good sport about it all. I've not been above that one myself. We put on the suits. They were about as similar to the old-time pressure suits described in the novels I like to read, as the ship is to that silly sailboat I once got sick in. In passing, I want to say that it used to strike me as odd the way nobody in the ship wrote novels at all. Nobody had for years and years and years, so that what I read dated from before the population wars. Right now, I'm not even sure why I liked to read them. Most of them weren't very good by any objective standard. Escapism, maybe. Anyway, our suits were an adaptation of the basic discontinuity principle that the ship used, too. To be analogous, and thereby inaccurate, remember that old saw about reaching inside a cat, grabbing it by the tail, and turning it inside out? The discontinuity effect, as far as the ship is concerned, grabs the universe by the tail and turns it inside out so as to get at it better. Strictly a local effect, but in the process, getting from here to there becomes a relatively simple matter instead of an intensely difficult one. The discontinuity effect doesn't work the same way in the suits. They are more of a self-contained little universe of their own. They were originally invented, my reading tells me, to fight battles, in part of a continuing effort to render individual soldiers invulnerable, and hence were light in weight, carried their own air, heat, air conditioning, light, etc. Plus, being proof against just about everything from concentrated light beams to projectiles to any of the unpleasant battery of gases that had been invented. Turned out, of course, that the suits were far more useful for constructive purposes, building the ships, than they had ever been in wartime. Militarily, of course, they were a bust. Everybody on old Earth who fought in one was long dead. But in their peaceful adaptations, they were still useful, and still in use, as witness. Working the lock to the grate outside was a simple matter. You began by pushing a priority button, since there was no sense in being embarrassed halfway in or out by somebody trying to come the other way. Going out, you let air into the lock, entered the lock yourself, let air out, and then went outside. Coming in, you let air out of the lock, if there was any, entered the lock, filled it with air, and then passed into the ship. Since Riggy had let the air out of the lock in order to pass out of it, we locked the controls, which also ensured the farther lock door was completely closed, and filled the lock with air. As we went in, At said, "Don't be too mad with Riggy. At least wait until you're all safely back here." Jimmy nodded, and with everybody saying good luck to us, we went into the airlock. Quite frankly, my nerves felt they could use all the good luck they could get. That was the biggest reason that I was, unnaturally for me, saying little or nothing. The door closed behind us, and with it, the sight of that cheery, bare little room and our friends. As the air silently slipped away around us in response to button pushing by Jimmy, he said, "When Riggy comes up and goes boo or whatever stupid thing he has in mind, just pretend you don't see him at all. Ignore him completely." I didn't like Riggy's butting in, so I nodded. "All right." Then the air was all out, and Jimmy opened the door at our feet. Since we were on the first level, which was down as far as you could go by the ship's internal orientation, we had to go farther down to go out. Jimmy motioned at the ladder, which reminded me of something. I wasn't exactly sure what.
"Go ahead," he said.
I grabbed the ladder and began to climb down. Then I remembered two other ladders, one to the sixth level and another down to a boat. That's what it was, damned ladders. Halfway down the tube, which was only 7 or 8 feet long, I suddenly felt dizzy, and my stomach turned topsy-turvy. And then I found that I was much lighter and standing on my head. It was the point where the internal gravity of the ship cut out, and the normal gravity of a small asteroid, no longer blanked out, took over. Down in the ship and down outside were just opposite, and I was passing from one to the other. So now I was pointed head down, but my feet were outside the tube, and with a little effort and the light gravity, I managed to scramble out. I stood up with a motion that left me with a whirling head and looked around. Overhead there was a sharp, eye-blurring silver grayness, marked by streaks and pinpoints of black, that almost edged over into purple. It hurt my eyes to look at it, and I was reminded of a photographic negative, even though this had a tone to it that no photograph ever had. It made you want to squint your eyes and look away, but there was no other place to look.
The rocky surface of the ship had an eerie, washed-out silver look to it, too. The rocks looked sterile and completely dead, as though no one had ever been here before, or would ever be here again. A playground for the Never Was, only a few feet away from the living, breathing, warm, real world I was used to, but effectively in another dimension. Almost as confirmation of the other dimensionality, Jimmy's legs suddenly stuck up out of the hole beside me as he came down. I helped him out. He sat beside the edge of the tube, as though to right his senses, and then looked around, just as I had. Beside us, apparently to mark the location of the lock, was an 8-foot pylon. On it were lock controls, a location number, and a crude sign, the joke, I suspect, of somebody long dead, that said in handwritten capitals, "Keep off the grass!" It gave me a shivering feeling to read it. I don't know if it was the probable age of the sign, the weird tone of its surroundings, the whirling of my head, or some combination. We looked around us silently, and then Jimmy said, "What are those?" Beyond the pylon, in the distance, was a long row of giant tubes projecting above the uneven rocky surface, like great guns pointed at the universe. They could not have been too far, since for all the irregularity of the ship's surface, the distance to the horizon was not great. Scout ship tubes, I think. I didn't realize that we were this close to the scout bay.
"Yes, I guess," Jimmy said.
The distortion that affected everything around us touched him, too. "You don't look very well," I said, peering at what I could see of him in his suit.
"I don't feel very well. I'm getting sick to my stomach. You don't look very well yourself."
"It's just the light," I said.
But that wasn't true. My dizziness was making me sick to my stomach, too.
I was almost afraid I was going to vomit, and out here in a suit was the worst possible place. So I said, "Where's Riggy? Shouldn't he have surprised us by now?" Jimmy slowly looked around.
"There are other locks. Maybe he went down one of them to leave us wondering."
"Maybe," I said. "I think we'd better look for him, though."
"What if he's hiding? Maybe that's his surprise."
There were so many tumbled rocks around us that if Riggy were hiding, it would be no simple thing to find him. He would be just another lump among many. Then our questions were answered for us. Jimmy said, "What was that?"
"What?"
The noise came again, and I heard it this time. A horrible retching sound. I had both send and receive controls on my suit turned low. But in spite of this, the sound was almost too much for me. My stomach heaved, and I had to fight to keep from throwing up, too. My head continued to spin.
"Where are you, Riggy?" Jimmy asked.
"I don't see him," I said. Riggy said nothing, just made that awful vomiting sound again. It didn't recommend him to me. Jimmy crouched then and jumped straight up in the air. In the light gravity, he went up a tremendous distance, perhaps 40 feet or more, and then down. He landed lightly, but then he said,
"I couldn't see him at all. I couldn't see a thing. Mia, go out about 100 or 150 feet toward the middle one of those big tubes and look for Riggy. I'll go in the other direction. We'll both make a half circle clockwise."
I stumbled away over the rocks toward the Scout Bay tubes, bouncing unevenly, slipping a couple of times, and not helped at all by the sound of Riggy and his vomiturition. I wanted to turn him off, but I didn't, because then I couldn't hear Jimmy. When I was about the right distance from the pylon, I started making my half circle. Then Jimmy said,
"Are you ready, Mia?"
"I've already started," I said.
"Riggy," Jimmy said, "if you don't want to be left out here, you'd better get to your feet and do your best to be found."
What I wanted most was to shut my eyes against the silver, just sit down and try to ease my spinning head. My eyes were beginning to ache and my ears to ring, and concentrate on quelling the nausea I felt. It reminded me of my sailing experience, but this was much worse.
It was all I could do to keep walking, and my feet were not going where I wanted them to. I didn't go exactly in a half circle, either. I tried to check on my position, to look for Riggy, and just to keep going. And I wasn't doing very well at any of them. I am completely convinced that the ultimate weapon is one that you can hold in your hand, point at a person, and thereby completely disrupt his sense of balance. All that he could do is lie in a puddled heap and puke. It would probably destroy the concept of heroics for all time. As light as the gravity was here, I had some trouble with my traction. In jumping from one rock to another, my foot slipped, my feet tangled, and then there wasn't a rock where I thought there was, and I took a header. Under normal gravity and without the protection of a suit, I would probably have been pretty badly hurt. As it was, I just fell. Unless you did some quiet practice first, without the distraction of this unsettling dizziness, I doubted the tremendous bounds that would be possible out here would be worth making. I lay there, fetched up against a rock that resembled nothing so much as a particularly hideous sculpture my mother once made. A distorted bust of old Lemuel Carpentier himself. The only thing that was in proper proportion was his nose, and that was his worst feature. He hadn't been pleased. Lying still, my head didn't clear, so I forced myself to stand up again. Then I saw Riggy. He was on his knees, if not on his feet. He was hidden completely from the pylon by a tent-like conglomeration of rocks, which had pitched together to form a sheltered area. He was still retching. I said to Jimmy, "I've found him." Then, because it didn't matter anymore and I wanted to save my stomach if I could, I shut off my receive line. I hardly looked at Riggy. I didn't want to. I got him on his feet, and then found that if I was careful about where I put my own feet as I walked, I could carry him. I kept my mind on reaching the pylon, and then Jimmy was beside us and helping me. We set Riggy down by the lock, and Jimmy pushed the lock controls on the pylon so that we could make our way inside. I said, "Go on through. I'll push him inside to you." Jimmy went ahead. He went head first down the hole, and then was gone. I waited a minute, and then I fed Riggy down the hole, too. I held him by the ankles. For a moment, there was a feeling exactly like that feeling of invisible force, when you push the similar poles of two magnets together. And Riggy was neither here nor there. But then Jimmy had him, and pulled him through. I went through after. When we were in the lock, Jimmy fed the air in. When the air was all in, the door to the lock room opened. By that time, I had the headpiece of my suit off, just in time, too. When the door opened, I took two steps forward and then threw up. It was, in a way, a considerable relief. Jimmy and I had been outside for 20 minutes, Riggy for 40. We recovered our equilibrium in a bare few minutes. But Riggy could do nothing but sit and look miserable and hold his head. When I threw up, Venny looked down at it, and then up at me. "You're going to have to clean that up," she said. "I'm not." Apparently, she felt she'd had enough of the dirty work on this little adventure. I didn't really blame her. I didn't have the strength. All I did was just sit down and close my eyes and give blessings that I was back in the real world again, even including Venny. Jimmy and Riggy and I just sat around, and the other three threw questions at us. Jimmy told them how it was. Riggy said weakly, "If anybody wants to go, I'll give them this suit." "It's hardly in shape for anybody to wear," Helen said, and that was true. For all that he had stopped being racked by heaves, Riggy and the inside of his suit were in impossible shape. Jimmy said, "We'd best get these things cleaned up and returned." We got Riggy out of his suit, and Venny was delegated to see that he got home. Helen and At took Riggy's suit off to clean it up, and Jimmy and I cleaned up the lock room. I don't know how Jimmy was able to keep his stomach from first to last, but he did. His iron constitution, I guess. When everything was cleaned up, we left At and Helen to close the lock room and go home. I had never realized before that adventures took so much doing.
So much preparation and so much cleaning up afterward. That's something you don't see in stories. Who buys the food and cooks it, washes the dishes, minds the baby, rubs down the horses, swabs out the guns, buries the bodies, mends the clothes, ties that rope in place so the hero can conveniently find it there to swing from, blows fanfares, polishes medals, and dies beautifully. All so that the hero can be a hero? Who finances him? I'm not saying I don't believe in heroes. I'm just saying that they are either parasites, or they spend the bulk of their time in making their little adventures possible, not in enjoying them. Cleaning up after ourselves, coupled with the left-handed direction everything had gone, took the sparkle out of us. Jimmy and I just tossed the suits over our arms and said goodbye to Helen and At, and went off toward salvage. Things had gone so unswimmingly that I suppose I should have expected that they would continue that way. On our way, we ran into George Fuonen. It was again a case of coming around a corner and not being able to avoid someone. Though in this case, we didn't stumble over him. We simply turned the corner and found him close enough that we couldn't ditch the suits or manage to go unseen.
"Hi, Mia,"
he said from down the hall.
"Hello," I said. "What are you doing down here?"
Jimmy looked up at the giant so uncertainly that I said,
"It's George Fuonen. He pilots a scout ship, for my dad sometimes," in an undertone.
"Oh," Jimmy said.
"I was looking for you, I think," George said as he came up. "I'm on constable call today and had a complaint from a Mrs. Keithley in engineers about two young cubs. A red-headed boy with ears that stick out, and I take it that's you," pointing at Jimmy, "and a black-haired little girl with bad manners. I'm not even making a guess as to who that is," he said, looking meaningfully at me.
"So perhaps we'd better go where we can talk, and while you're about it, you might explain what you're doing with those suits."
"We were returning them," I said. George looked at us quizzically. The aftermath I don't care to go into detail about. Mr. Mitchell was quite genuinely hurt to think he had been used. I could tell that he was hurt when he handed each of us our pins, both of which turned out very nicely indeed. That was at a meeting in Daddy's office, with Daddy, Mr. Mitchell, Miss Spring Cusick, who was Jimmy's dorm mother, and Mr. Mbili. They sat on one side of the room, and Jimmy and I sat on the other. Mrs. Keithley wasn't there, thank heaven. The meeting was uncomfortable enough without her, too. She entered the meeting. We were told to avoid her strictly from now on. I could see that Mr. Mitchell had been hurt, but I didn't really understand why. It was spelled out for us. I had been looking at it from my point of view, that he was in our way and might have stopped us if we had just tried to ask for the suits. I hadn't seen things from his angle at all, that we had used him the way you use a handkerchief. I've always thought more in terms of things than of people, and I'm sometimes slow to put myself in somebody else's shoes. When I did, I wasn't happy about what I'd done, which I think was Daddy's intention. They didn't question us about who used the third suit, but they did point out how stupid and dangerous it had been for us.